stick up, chick.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, I just couldn't put this off any longer, but I'm afraid I'm in need of another little hit of McKenna, Abraham, and Sheldrake in one of their trilogues. But I don't want you to get worried now. I'm not going to go on another one of those long series of nothing but trilogues. I just needed a little McKenna fix, if you know what I mean. The conversation I'm going to play today was actually recorded on June 8, 1998 at Santa Cruz, California. And in the box of cassette recordings of these trilogues that Ralph Abraham loaned to me for this project, this trilogue was the most recent one. Actually, there were three tapes with that date on them, and they're each about an hour and a half long. So right now I'm going to play the first hour of the first tape, and we'll get to the rest of that tape in another podcast later this week. But since today's program is so long, I'm going to dispense with most of my usual chatter and join you in listening to Terrence McKenna, Ralph Abraham, and Rupert Sheldrake talk about skepticism and the balkanization of epistemology.
Well, what I thought it would be interesting to discuss as part of our new series of trilogues, because I think it's an issue that more and more people are becoming aware of, is the whole question of skepticism and what I call the balkanization of epistemology. And what I mean by that is that somehow, as a part of the agenda of political correctness, it has become not entirely acceptable to criticize or demand substantial evidence or expect people, when advancing their speculations, to make what used to be called old-fashioned sense. And I think this tolerance of unanchored thought and speculation is confusing the evolutionary progress of discourse. But I'm also aware that if you draw the parameters too tight, the baby goes out with the bathwater, or you become a defender of scientism or some kind of orthodoxy. So in my own situation, I've been trying to both understand what is strong and to be supported in science and what needs to be criticized, and equally to look at the alternatives to science, the counterculture, the new age, and to ask myself what is strong, what serves the evolution of discourse, and what is in fact this type of unanchored thinking that I'm concerned about. So first let me talk a little bit about how I see science. If any one of us were to take what is called a scientific approach to many of the phenomena that interest us, psychic pets, the source of the content of the psychedelic experience, etc., etc., if we were to take a hard scientific view of these things, these phenomena, which we know exist and which we find rich in implications, would simply not be allowed as objects of discourse. They would be ruled out of order. So there's something wrong on one level with scientific, what's called empirical, empiricism, skepticism, positivism, it has different names. On the other hand, if we go to the other end of the spectrum and are willing to admit the testimony of iridologists, crop circle enthusiasts, victims of alien abduction, those who channel Atlantis, those who suspect undetected planets, those who believe vast alien arcologies dot the plains of Mars and so forth.
And pro bono, better get that in.
Yes, pro bono proctologists from other star systems making unscheduled house calls late at night in our homes. I mean, both of you realize, I'm sure, that medical professionals, regardless of their species or star system of origin, do not make house calls anymore. So, I see then this problem. Science is too tight-fisted. It misses much of what is interesting. To abandon approach of science is to just be without rudder in an ocean of strident claims and counterclaims, many of which are preposterous and certainly not all of which can be true. So, after thinking about this for a while, my approach was to say, well, science went from superstition to its present positivist position through a process of evolution, temporal unfoldment. So, using a method I've advocated in other situations, I conducted the following exercise. I said, I will move backward through the epistemological history of science to the last sane moment science knew, and then analyze what that consists of. And I'm not completed in this process, but what I find is that a curious betrayal has occurred in science, that with the rise of capitalism and industrialism, science has actually become, has allowed assumptions to be made that betrayed its original intent. And what I mean by that is modern science relies on statistical analysis of data. You know, measure 10 times, add the values, divide by 10. This tells you how much rain is falling, how much voltage is flowing through a wire, something like that. This approach to phenomena mitigates against unusual phenomena.
Inevitably,
because they are statistically insignificant. That's the phrase that is actually used. So we can talk about this in detail. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I think you see my implication that the method of statistical analysis, true, produces general formalizations of nature's mechanisms and wonderful products which can be sold and patented and so forth. But it's a coarse-grained view of nature, and what it mitigates against seeing are the very things which feed the progress of science, which is the unassimilated phenomena, the unusual data, the peculiar result of an experiment. So looking at that then, I said, well, where are we in the history of science, where this happened, and how was it before? And you may wish to correct me 100 years either way, but I'm very interested in sort of bringing back and reappreciating William of Ockham, who, aside from the things I'm saying about him here, which are very nice, also had a notion not much appreciated of what he called unlimited progress. And it comes very close to novelty theory's belief that the universe progresses unto emerging with the nature of God. But the thing about Ockham that bears on all this is, of course, his famous razor, which simply says, it's been interpreted many ways, but hypotheses should not be multiplied without necessity. Or, to put it more simply, the simplest explanation of any phenomena should be preferred until found inadequate. Explanation should not be complexified beyond the demands of the problem against which it's being brought to bear. So what I'm feeling is, if we abandon statistical analysis of nature and realize that probably the assumption of temporal invariance that that assumes about the underlying fields of nature is in fact a cheerful assumption, untested and unprovable. So we should get rid, in my hypothetical reformation of epistemological dialogue, we should get rid of statistical analysis. We should dial science back to the late medieval period of Occam, and we should do science that way. And applying Occam's razor, we're quickly able to cut away the underbrush that these peripheral and alternative people have brought to the table. Some of it's good. Things like hypnotism, acupuncture, nutrition therapy, rational approaches to telepathy, clairvoyance. None of this is what I have a problem with. I don't have a problem with people proposing new models of nature. What I have a problem with is unanchored, eccentric revelations taking their place at the table. The channelings from the Palladians, for example, the Sitchinite reconstruction of the ancient Near Eastern archaeology, the Arguellian distortion of the Mayan accomplishment. I find these things pernicious and easily dealt with if we use Occam's razor. But when we go too far into statistical analysis of nature, then we begin to cut away at our own beliefs and assumptions about nature. Yours, Rupert, of the morphogenetic field, mine of novelty theory, and there must be some aspect of all this that would threaten you, Ralph, if extremely empiricist and positivist criteria were brought to bear. In other words, we've all been called soft in our time, but in fact, I think our softness indicates a failure of science. Science has whored itself to the marketplace and to technology, and interesting high-order phenomena like societies, economic crashes, complex system behavior is going to remain forever blurred in our understanding as long as we rely on statistical analysis. It's a tool, it had its place, but to hold on to it indefinitely is going to retard mathematics' ability to give a deeper account of nature. A perfect example of this, and then I'll stop, would be the enshrinement of the so-called uncertainty principle in physics throughout the 20th century, you know, the supposed great bridge between science and mysticism. Well, it turns out it's just malarkey. There is no uncertainty principle. David Bohm's formulation of the quantum physics gives perfect knowledge of velocity and position without ambiguity. It calls forth the notion of non-locality. That's why the Heisenberg formulation was preferred. But again, non-locality accepted permits some of the things we're interested in. Telepathy, information from other worlds arriving via the morphogenetic field, so forth and so on. So I haven't been maybe as rabble-rousing as you expected by naming in turn various heresies to be consigned to the flames, but I do think there are too many loose heads in our canoe, and that no revolution of human thought that I'm aware of succeeded through fuzzy thinking.
Well, I've certainly got a lot to say about all that. Very interesting. I think that first of all, we have to see that there's a regional problem here, that skepticism and Occamism and so on carry different social balances in different parts of the world. You live in Hawaii and visit places like Maui quite frequently. Ralph lives right here in Santa Cruz, California, where you only have to mention the name to anyone in England who knows California at all, and they immediately say, oh yeah, where all the old hippies hang out. And it's the kind of, it's a totally alternative place. And as we've seen in our joint appearances in Santa Cruz, there's a level of weirdness among some of the theories people have and the crank obsessions they follow, which from outside the perspective of the West Coast, most people would recognize as typically Californian. There's a kind of level of weirdness and cults and these, I mean, most of the phenomena you've named are phenomena of Hawaii and California. When you live in England, things take on a rather different perspective. There's a general level of popular skepticism, such as that the general tone of an English pub is one of sort of skepticism.
And well, but aren't crop circles and Graham Hancock all homegrown British phenomena?
They are, but every single one of them in any single pub where it's debated would always have skeptics in the discussion. You're never going to have a kind of thing where you have all believers, except in small crank societies of true believers, which exist. But the thing is, the general cultural tone is one of skepticism. And so the need for a great deal more of skepticism doesn't feel quite so urgent if you live in London as it does if you live in Hawaii or California. That's my first point. But secondly, I think that the scientific skepticism you talk about is indeed a serious threat, and I think that's done more than anything to drive science in this direction. It's a kind of dogmatic skepticism that rules out at any cost weird phenomena like telepathy, non-locality, etc. And so to rule those out, you have to say that a lot of phenomena don't really exist, like telepathy and stuff. And if non-locality happens, it's just a peculiarity of the details of quantum theory with no wide
statistical anomaly gets rid of all problems.
So you can take these points of view, but the sceptical, those kind of dogmatic sceptics who I find myself confronted with quite often, the sceptical inquirer crowd, who are on my case whenever they can be, because they've classified me with the pro bono proctologists from distant star systems. So the thing is, I've had the experience of being put in that category by sceptics, including the editor of Nature. And there are sceptics in Britain who regularly appear, and good for a quote any time by the press. My old friend Professor Lewis Walcott, at any moment, and to any journalist, several times a year, will say, can't take this kind of thing so seriously. And then last year, when he said, but Professor Walcott, don't you think you should keep an open mind about some of these things? He says, not so open that your brain drops out. So that kind of skeptic has done a great deal to force science into this narrow thinking mold. It's forced the investigation of telepathy into more and more ridiculously detailed and unrealistic parapsychology lab experiments, seeking to provide the statistical proof of regularities. However, What I've found is with the staring experiments and with the psychic PET experiments, one can achieve results, positive results, which fit with all this normal statistical thing. They're repeatable, positive, they meet all these statistical criteria. They're not evanescent phenomena like human synchronicities. These are regularities of nature. So the old-style statistical approach can actually take us much further, I think. I'm using old-style statistical methods in my own research because I don't want to change both the content and the style at the same time. You know, I want to show that by the old methods, these are valid criteria. So, via valid phenomena, they actually happen, and you can prove them in the old style scientific way. But I do agree that the kind of discussion we have in science doesn't need to have all these things. What I like most, I think my most heroic example in the kind of thing I do is none other than the great late Charles Darwin. And like most other biologists, I greatly admire him, but what I see in him and admire is different from what others admire. I like his the way he draws on information from non-professionals, plant breeders, pigeon fanciers,
horse trainers,
cabbage breeders, rose planters and specialists, horticulturalists. He draws on all these people's experience, colonial explorers, sailors who tell of feral pigs on remote islands and how they've gone wild and so forth. All this is what Darwin draws on, and he discusses it in a common sense way. There's no statistical test, chi-squared test, 5% levels of probability. It's wonderful science. It draws on experience and treats it in the light of common sense using rules of evidence, but without rigid statistical tests, rigid methods. And it's wonderful science. He discovered a great deal. He'd never heard of 5% levels of probability. And yet it's great science. So I think that there is a possibility to return to a more common sense approach, and common sense of the British pub type, and probably of standard American kind too, will often deal quite satisfactorily with the pro bono proctologists from outer space. Anyone who claimed that in a British pub would be the butt of a great deal of humour within minutes. And
no pun intended.
Yes.
Well, let me just say about that, there is a political problem. You're right, though the British have this reputation in America for being the epitome of politeness. Actually, in a British pub, people are willing to blow the whistle on what they perceive as absurdity.
By jokes, yes. Always with humour.
In the New Age, it is utterly humourless, and the reigning paradigm of political correctness demands that you treat all of these testimonies and bits of news with complete equanimity, and it's thought to be rather out of sorts to suggest that anybody shouldn't be taken seriously. The belief is that truth can't be known, and so all there is opinion. So, you know, you speak from your knowledge of the calculus and world history, and this person speaks from their latest transmission from fallen Atlantis, and this is all placed on an equal footing. And it's crazy making, and it also guarantees the trivialness of the entire enterprise. I mean, I just don't think any revolution in human history can be made by fluffheads.
Well, I think in order to understand what you're saying, I have to really try to figure out what a fluffhead is.
Yes.
This is the crux. I like your historical approach, as we agree that science is rather in a bad place now. We can look back, find where it went wrong, go back there, start over again. This is exactly what fundamentalists do. They say, our ethics are gone, so we're going to go back to the first speeches of Muhammad or something. So, William of Ockham, I feel uncomfortable with his idea of simplicity. I mean, the modern form is probably Kolmogorov's measure of complexity, which would be, given a data set, what is the length in bytes of the smallest computer program that can approximate the data set within epsilon or something like that. And a problem with this, technically speaking, is that last year's technology would give a Kolmogorov measure of this much, and this year's technology would give a much smaller measure, because we've learned a new trick of building models, or it may only depend upon the computer language, more or less, that's used to build the model. So, in other words, that there is no simple measuring stick of simplicity. And given three explanations, we're not sure what is the simplest one. There's no mathematics that could really be applied. It becomes a subjective judgment. And therefore, I think that this whole question, where I think that you've suggested a one-dimensional scale of fluffheadness, then a fluff scale, where down at this end, we have what even Walpert thinks is okay. And over at that end, we have the test that can be applied to Pleiadians to see if they're real or not. So in this scale, I think you've marked two points. There's the point at which you think to the right of this is too fluffy and to the left is okay. And then there's another point where science degrees it's okay. You see that you're ruling out, like, the channeling, no, but the telepathy, okay. But Walker says the morphogenetic fields is not okay, but DNA is okay. So I'm thinking of these two points that you described as being on some linear scale of fluffness. And I'm thinking that this entire scale of fluffness is not, I mean, you'd like to appeal to mathematics and to some kind of real science, that there is a real science, that the community or the religion of science has gotten off the track of the real science, and that there, this is what bothers me, and I wish that this were true, but I have no faith in it, that there is somewhere in the sky or in the deepest bowels of the earth a measuring stick where we could somehow measure the truth of something, even if it's just a degree of truth, as, you know, in chaos logic, you don't have true and false. You have a truth is a percentage between 0 and 100%, and is only, chaos logic would be a good alternative for you. The truth of a proposition, let's say a formal logic, like Zeno's paradox, is only a temporal assessment and is the input of the measuring stick of truth, after which we get another measurement. You see, so now under what we know so far, it's 60% true. Now, we assume that it's 60% true, that's the input to another assessment. When we find out it's 66% true, and without the input of another assessment, then it's 64% true. Hopefully this process of successive judgments, which could be regarded as the history of science from the past through William of Ockham on into the infinite future, would converge on something. But in chaotic logic, it doesn't converge, because certain kind of propositions, which are circular in a way, like Zeno's paradox, they, in circling around, they have a chaotic attractor, and so they're always giving different results, never settles down. It gives a dense set of estimates between 0 and 100%. And from this perspective, which is the successor of Aristotelian logic, which served science up until the year 1985 or something, you can't have a clear measuring stick of truth, and you can't have a clear scale of fluff. And so the attempt to make something perfectly clear might be doomed to failure. We understand it then as something psychological. So I just want to give I'm applying Ludwig Fleck here to you. And Ludwig Fleck is the founder of the sociology of science, where you sort of do Freudian analysis of the scientific community as a flock of sheep, as it were. And with, like in the 60s, we were, as parents, very libertine with our children. Now we see those children have grown up, and my children are having children, and they're like much stricter. And there's the idea that in successive generations, people are more or less strict with their children. And I think they're more or less strict about fluff also. So that the fluff scale is actually a sociological aspect of a given culture or civilization, which fluctuates wildly in time. And I think that this is just one of many theories for you personally, and maybe we are also affected by this, that as we age and then we are in contact with young people and then we are receiving input from them as far as the morphogenetic sequence of a fluff scale is concerned, that we're affected by them and we're becoming a little more critical. You see, so then we become critical of ourselves in a way, because a decade ago we were more open. So our fluff scale is changing, and therefore we have to rearrange all our social grid, that some people that were previously okay are now too fluffy for us, and their brains have fallen out.
Well, let me say a couple of things about this. First of all, I think I agree with almost everything you say. On the end of pointing out that its truth is a very difficult thing to assess, you didn't mention Kurt Gödel, but certainly his proof that no formal system produces all true statements shows that even ordinary arithmetic is subject to debate and represents a kind of circularity. So on one end, I completely agree with you that truth is a very complicated concept, and why shouldn't it be? It's motivated thinkers since thinking began. And we as yet have no certain index for it. You mentioned that you thought my approach was one-dimensional, and I agreed from your example. But much of your criticism was couched in the vocabulary of symbolic logic, analytical deconstruction. Here's a way we might go at this. Agreeing that it's a messy problem, let's agree that the solution may also be somewhat messy. So, for instance, we perhaps need to talk about kinds of fluff. I immediately identify two kinds of fluff. One is unscientific speculation, persistent throughout history and with a consistent provenance.
I.e. religion.
Well,
mythology.
I wasn't going to attack religion. I was thinking of more marginal ideas, but religion is a good example. I was going to suggest alchemy. Alchemy believes certain things about matter, which science absolutely abhors and rejects. The history of alchemy is far older than the history of science. It has always been in existence. Its thinkers have always evolved and adumbrated their field of concerns. So that's one kind of fluff. Fluff with punch, because it has historical continuity. But what are we to make of someone who brings to the idea a complete cosmological model generated in the past 10 years by themselves alone? They never read Plato, they know no mathematics, they never read the Bible, they never read Wittgenstein, they just got it all in one download, and it is on the face of it preposterous. It's a faith that tells you that vegetables lose their auric fields unless peeled with wooden implements, that major earth changes have already happened but are invisible to most people, that there are only 100 real people alive on the planet anyway, everyone else is a simulacrum from another dimension. In other words, preposterous on the face of it, historyless, idiosyncratic, and utterly unanchored to any body of previous human thought, sanctioned or unsanctioned.
So the question before us is, how do we distinguish all these books from one that superficially might appear to be in that genre, The Invisible Landscape? How do we make a division between the invisible landscape on the one hand and the rest on the other?
Oh, well, the invisible landscape, the category of the invisible landscape is I Ching commentary.
I'm writing one right now.
Well, they've been, the I Ching is a legitimate object of speculative discourse, has been since pre-Han time.
Okay, so let's say we accept a two-dimensional model for fluff, where there's deeper fluff like I Ching commentaries and more superficial fluff like the entire manifest universe is the circulation of a single electron.
Let's use the Urantia book as an example.
So in this case...
Or the pattern we were given last night, a spiral form of the basis of
the reality. We have one here.
Made of wire.
So I think that... I'll give you a point here, in that Occam's razor is intuitively a good way to describe this new dimension. The simpler and more complicated explanations for an effect which is, as a matter of fact, not established. So this is my worry about the anti fluff posture that you now project in public and so on. That's, I'm sympathetic with a lot of things, and we worry greatly about the pattern. And the problem with this strict parent approach to fluff is is that some important discoveries may be shuttled aside, as Walford shoves aside Rupert's idea of the morphogenetic field. What is it that science hates? Hates, besides Rupert, science hates homeopathy, acupuncture, or alternative medicine altogether. Science hates cold fusion. I mean, there are certain things. They say, well, you know, too open-minded. To even think about things, too open-minded, too much in conflict. So a lot of things would have been missed. You think of these paradigm shifts of the past of science. For example, the continental drift, or the ice ages. I can see, I mean, you know, this was a really terrific discovery of mountain climbing guides of the ice age theory that we don't take for granted, rejected by science for 30 or 40 years, and is one of the few successful examples of a paradigm shift in science. This scientific community
Brilliant.
Is so
I've
legal.
Never even thought of it as a paradigm shift.
Oh, it's
seamlessly
a terrific story.
Incorporated
I tell
science.
In great detail in my book, Haskai Aros, including a heroic picture of Agassiz himself. He was taken into the mountains by these mountain climbing guide, said, look here at the Jura mountains, the limestone mountains, what are these hunks of granite doing here? They've been brought here from over there where we know where the granite is. And wonderful story.
You mentioned 30 or 40 years, Ralph. I think one way of thinking about this problem is some school of fluff should be given a certain amount of time to advance their agenda.
It's
very,
budget.
Very messy.
Yes.
But if after 20, 30, 40 years they've gotten nowhere, they should not lose their place in the discourse or move to the back of the room or something. And I think this should be applied to science as well. For example, science has been beating its breast since 1950 about how they were about to elucidate the mechanism of memory. I think it's time to just pull the plug on it. You've had 50 years to flail at this with every tool available, and you have zilch to show for it. Similarly, if the people who believe aliens from other star systems are visiting this planet with great plans for mankind, they've been running that riff since 1947. It's time for them to lower their voices and let other people have something to say.
Well, maybe a century or two. Why are you so tight?
Because if there is no progress, there are other fields have created multiple revolutions
in the same
time scale.
Progress is very subtle. So while looking for memory engrams in the brain, they didn't find them, but they did figure out how to do a certain kind of surgery so that if you have a tumor or something, they can do a really good job of helping you out. So,
well, I would challenge you to make a list of spin-off effects from the new age that have eased the suffering of mankind. I mean, there have been a few back scratchers and some nutritional supplements and a mantra or two, but in terms of the money consumed, the lives distorted, the hypola that we've all had to put up with, posturing,
we feel nervous about censorship. I think, okay, if we were the National Science Foundation and we'd been funding channelers for years, hoping that they would find gold in South America, then we might withdraw our funding at this point, but we can't make it illegal somehow for them to channel.
No. What we have to legitimize is critical discussion, so that when someone stands up and starts talking about the face on Mars, people behave as they apparently behave in British pubs and just stand up and say, "Malarkey, mate." And, you know, force people to experience a critical deconstruction of their ideas. the face on Mars thing is a perfect example. Here in, 76, Voyager sends a low-resolution image, might be a face. All of these self-promoting so-called ex-NASA scientists, I mean, when I hear the phrase ex-NASA scientist in the New Age, I reach for my revolver. So all of these ex-NASA scientists gather around, proclaim this thing an alien artifact. When the first Mars orbiter fails at orbital injection around Mars, they scream conspiracy. Mankind isn't ready for the truth. 18 months later, the second Martian orbiter goes into orbit flawlessly. NASA, responding to the previous hullabaloo, actually moves this site up in its photographic agenda. Photographs it exactly under the conditions these people say it must be photographed on. It's clearly an eroded mesa, part of the Martian landscape, no different from any other. And immediately the Face on Mars people scream that the data has been tampered with, that all kinds of terrible things have gone on. One guy sent me email saying, well, there isn't a face on Mars, but there will be in the future. Someone else wrote me and said, well, obviously, the aliens wouldn't leave an artifact. The face on Mars is cleverly disguised as an eroded mesa.
Well, I agree, but I'm not sure that it's good to rant against the face on Mars, because there's no way by William of Ockham or whatever, that you could have ruled out the possibility that there was really a pocket watch on Mars. And now, in fact, they do, there's life here and there. There's water on the moon, there's a pocket watch on Mars. There's not a face on Mars, but there's something that nobody suspected that was found by going there. So my fear is that by drawing the line too tight, that many discoveries will be missed. They'll be missed. And that a certain amount of open-mindedness is necessary to for novelty to come in and to nourish the evolution of the collective mind.
And I've got an answer to this, a political answer, because however much we choose to make criteria or define what, we'd have no power whatever to enforce them unless we were on a funding committee of the National Science Foundation or the government or the British Medical Research Council, or we were an editor of a prominent journal like Nature or Science or so forth. Under those conditions, through controlling grants or through controlling editorial policies of major journals, you really shape and influence the science community. You are the ones that draw the line about what papers are published in Nature. I mean, people like Sir John Maddox, who opposed my work, declared in public, in an editorial, this work, seemingly scientific by someone with seeming scientific credentials, etc., was actually outside the possible area of rational scientific discourse. So there was a line drawn, put on an index. So there are people who do that, but we're not in those positions, nor are people in those positions very likely to listen to what we say. So the realistic question is, how in fact does all this work, and how politically could the system be reformed? Here I rely on a book by a dissident Cambridge biochemist who wrote a book called The Economic Laws of Scientific Research, and his name I forget, but I remember it. But anyway, in this book he shows that if you look at the structure of scientific research funding, you find that in the 19th century, when there was a great deal of scientific creativity and originality in both Britain and America, there was a great diversity of sources of funding. There was very little public money in science, practically none. And it came from innovators, companies that needed to do the science in order to make the chemicals and stuff. No one was going to tell them or give them. They had to do this. Engineering research, a study of the Adam Smith study of the Industrial Revolution in Lancashire, found that the improvements in spinning jennies and steam-driven machinery came not from experts, not from mathematicians, but it was mostly done by illiterate technicians who were improving the machines that they ran and understood from day to day, the mechanics. And this innovation was mechanic new technology came from old technology. Science had nothing to do with it. He shows if you study the history of technology, most of it, most new technologies have arisen in this way. Science was funded by a diversity of bodies and was quite diverse. On the continent, in Germany and France, where they had centrally state-controlled policies in the 19th century, the universities were funded by the state, and there was a Ministry of Science, and they had central institutes. It was highly professionalized and institutionalized, with professors with great power. In Britain and America at that period, there was actually no science in universities. And now, after the Second World War, the biggest change happened after the Second World War, when people like Vannevar Bush got the idea of a military-industrial complex with big science, huge government funding for defense research, which linked in the universities to a huge government-funded program of research. And then with the National Science Foundation, this model was extended to medicine. But the primary one is the military research budget, billions and billions of dollars driving research in laboratories, Los Alamos, you know, Lawrence Livermore, and so forth, all around the United States and in the major contracts with universities. Then you have a centralized system of science funding through, as we have it in Britain, through research councils, central government research councils, which define spending for engineering research, sociology research, medical research. Who gets the grants? And these are run by small committees of professors and experts. You know, people like Edward Teller were on these committees. And they decide the science funding, the structure of what's permitted and funded through the whole system. This imposes a kind of monopoly control, a kind of uniformity of thought, which is the enemy of deviant thinking that doesn't fit within that system, however well or badly the lines are drawn. You can't do anything that's not within the center. The only answer to this, he suggests, because he's an Adam Smith follower, is not to follow Bacon's idea, which is Francis Bacon's vision was central government spending, you know, an academy of scientists, state-owned, like a sort of state priesthood of scientists. And then they think of new ideas, which then go to the mechanics to turn into new technologies, and science fuels this progress. He shows that, in fact, technology fuels technology. Science hasn't got that much to do with it. If you look at different science spending in different advanced countries, pure science research has not that much to do with it. But the pure science people have to do it on the centralized funding program in accordance with defense aims, the war against cancer, AIDS, you know, all the great agendas set by centralized science, molecular biology and biotechnology now taking over the life sciences. The only answer in practice is a free market answer. Whether you abolish or greatly reduce central government spending, science is then paid for in accordance with enough lobby. Any interest group that's got enough lobbying power would vie for it. There's a huge organic consuming community. They'd lobby for money to be spent on organic farming research, etc. At present, it gets practically nothing because it's not part of the central agricultural research program geared towards Monsanto chemicals and so forth. So, if you, in fact, this central monopolistic legacy of the Baconian heritage, which is really what he was, the Lord Chancellor of England, it's an old style monarchical church and state, top-down hierarchical structure run by a small elite accountable to nobody, whose these priorities, if priorities were set by popular opinion, pet research would be top of the biological agenda, not the sequencing of more proteins, the cloning of more sheep to help the biotechnology industry. But instead, pet research isn't even on the agenda. So it's set by a small elite who bear no relation in their interest to the voters in a democracy who actually provide the money.
But on the other hand, you would have then the astronomical budget would be entirely spent looking for UFOs.
No, it wouldn't, because if you had, you'd have some kind of funding agency which would give matching grants to organizations. If a UFO organization applies for a grant for UFO research, you'd have a sort of advanced funding agency which could fund this kind of thing. If you had a central funding agency, it would be either have many more subdivisions or sub-offices, or would have a great deal more, less hierarchical structure. It would be done on a regional basis, a state basis, anything to allow for quirkiness and deviation and multiplicity of decision-making. But all of these would be answerable. If you got a grant for your UFO project for 5 years, you've got $50,000 a year for 5 years or something. At the end of the 5 years, you submit a report, and this is published in scientific journals, which are open to this kind of thing, like the Journal of Scientific Exploration. It will publish scientific papers on the face on Mars, but anyone can write in and say why they think this isn't good enough evidence, and the debate's there in the journal. And you can see both sides of the argument. They do this. They've done the face on Mars. Then the new evidence, someone then publishes a new picture, the new evidence of the face on Mars, and the person who wrote the original can write a reply. But for most people, a kind of new consensus would develop, that there isn't much in it.
Well, one of the things I've noticed in talking to people about these problems is that pseudoscience is very difficult for most people to discern. In other words, if you dig into the face on Mars problem, you'll find all kinds of articles with pretentious titles about information theory and higher dimensional reconstructions of the data, so that before the spacecraft arrived, we supposedly had terrain models of what it was going to see based on extrapolation of the early data. And well, inevitably, these people are all PhDs, and they use these technical languages very adroitly. So, you know, along with the idea that there should be some kind of historical continuity, and I agree, diversifying the hierarchical spending patterns would help. The other thing is, there needs to be some way of, and this has never been done in science, because I guess it was never necessary, because the collegial atmosphere was self-policing, but there should be a way of looking at the messenger.
Well, I'm not very keen on your messenger point, because it leads to ad hominem arguments. You see, the classic thing you should avoid in proper rational discourse traditionally is ad hominem arguments, attacking the messenger and not the message. And ad hominem attacks, where people who say things that you don't like, they can be destroyed by smear campaigns, like Randy trying to smear Geller, or Geller hitting back by saying Randy is a pederast and a paedophile and a totally dishonest and disreputable character, pervert, and so on. And this kind of ad hominem argument is all too common in practice. When Randy attacks Geller on the ad hominem grounds, look at the messenger, a guy who was on did cheap music hall acts in Israel and stuff, and then comes, he's just a showman. He hits back, you see, but that's where you get with ad hominem arguments. You get Geller and Randy. And Randy's supposed to be a rationalist.
Well, it's a problem. I mean, I would like to know these things about someone I was debating, but I agree with you, it's not a valid point to bring forward. But if, for example, you're dealing with a supposed guru, but you know that he's done time for fraud, embezzlement, and auto theft, I think that in a debate about his theology, that would not be proper to bring forward. But on the other hand, you certainly would want to know that.
Yes, but it is a venue, you get the kind of the worst kind of prurient popular press ad hominem attack, where anyone in public life, immediately they're going to find out if they've got mistresses, illegitimate children, and blaze this stuff all over the papers. That means that people in public life, politicians and so on, the slightest sexual affair, etc., now becomes enormous. I mean, Clinton, no one outside America can believe this fascination with whether or not
there's no fascination. 72% of the people would like to get on with it.
Exactly,
this is a slow-moving coup d'etat driven by religious maniacs of the extreme.
I don't think it's a religious mania. I think there's some kind of this kind of ad hominem business. It's the stuff of popular TV, the press, etc., etc. There's too much of it in the modern world.
Well,
it would mean you don't believe
it's inescapable. I think. I mean the. monopolistic control of the financing of scientific research worldwide is bad and it's important and so on. Nevertheless, the National Science Foundation does rely on the judgment of these peer reviewers and group of experts and so on. Finally, it's their opinions that direct the flow of money, and that would also be true if there was no central control and had every industry financing its own research. Actually,
yes,
there is
better. You'd get more opinions.
The cat food industry, there are two or three companies that are outstanding for their research on the dietary needs of cats and dogs, and they do this research based on funds that are coming in from pet owners and so on. This is the 19th century model. It still exists to a degree. And even in those companies, there's a group of people who are deciding how to spend their money. And maybe they're influenced by the criminal records of some of the researchers and so on. But finally, it's the opinion of any, even a person in the street with a dollar to give to the March of Dimes or something. It's a question of opinion, and that's where Ludwig Fleck comes in, the sociology of science. These journals are important. What you can publish, that's why we don't like censorship. People should at least be able to voice their theory about the face on Mars or whatever, the pattern and so on. So it's, I think, very important who can publish and not publish in magazines like Magical Blend. And even if we aren't on committees of the National Science Foundation, if we do speak and give opinions about these magazines and so on, then we're affecting their editorial policies. How do they decide whether to publish these articles or not? The hope that there is some measuring stick of truth, that you could be clear-headed, like to use like Aristotelian logic or something, want to be clear-headed, it's very hard to distinguish. We do not have a science, as a matter of fact, that allows us to distinguish one theory versus another, Occam's razor, or any other way. We don't have. Finally, we're going to use our intuition, and we may take into account arguments ad hominem while doing so secretly, of course, and while saying the opposite, we nevertheless consider the gender and so on. So I don't this is what's worried me about things like crop circles, the pattern, and so on. I do not stand up and speak against them because I do not trust my own bias against them. It could be true. A new face on Mars could be discovered. A channel containing a quartz crystalled watch could be found under the left paw of the Sphinx. I mean, I'm not sure that these claims are not true. I think they're not very simple. There's some things that aren't interesting. I don't care if there's face on Mars or not. I do think the age of the Chops Pyramid is kind of an interesting question because the whole skeleton of history is, Newton wrote a book called the Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms Amended. He's interested in getting the chronology of the Old Testament into the proper order and so on.
Well, I think we're all interested in these things. The thing is not to be led astray by people who have, for whatever reason, a different notion of evidence, a different notion of truth than we do.
Well, the medical profession, I think that it's based on good science and so on. Now, I believe in vitamin C. I don't believe in it, but I have. I take vitamin C. I took some today. 10 years ago, my doctor, the best doctor I had, told me that vitamin C was hogwash. It's like morphogenetic fields to him. Now he believes in it. What's happened, it took a while to accumulate enough, not evidence, enough convergence of opinion, enough consensus, really, that he could have faith in it among the people who are question authority. That's the
something that is making the conversation difficult, and it has to do with...
I'm sorry to have to cut this off right here, but we're already a little over the one-hour time limit I try to impose on these podcasts. And as I mentioned in the beginning of this program, I'm going to keep my own comments to a minimum and get the rest of this trialogue out to you in the next couple of days. There are only about 30 minutes or so left in this conversation about skepticism, but there are several comments from our fellow saloners that I think are important, and I don't want to just squeeze them in a hurry here, so I'll get to those comments and the rest of this trilogue, and I'll get them out in a separate podcast as soon as I can. In the time I have left, however, I do want to thank our fellow saloners, Terry, Corey, Patricia, and Adam, all of whom sent in donation in the past couple of weeks. It's incredibly wonderful of you all to do that, and I want you to know that your gifts will reach a lot of people because they're going to be used 100% in support of these podcasts. So many thousands of fellow saloners the world over also thank you for your support of the Psychedelic Salon. Without you guys and the others who have sent in donations to help with equipment and hosting expenses, I might have given up doing this a long time ago. But the fact that so many of you feel so strongly about these podcasts that you send some of your hard-earned cash this way, well, it brings tears to my eyes to know that you care that much. It really does. And I'm also talking about all of you who have told your friends about these podcasts, too. You know, each week, hundreds of new listeners join us. And it's quite amazing, really, to see how much interest there is in the area of consciousness expansion. I don't know where we're going with these podcasts, but I do know that it's a very enjoyable ride, at least for me. And so thank all of you for your kind words and support, and in particular, thank you again, Terry, Corey, Patricia, and Adam, who are among the salon's staunchest supporters. It's good to know you're here with us in Cyberdelic space. And as always, before I go, I should mention that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 2.5 license. If you have any questions about that, you can click on the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at matrixmasters.com/podcasts. And if you still have any questions about that or anything else, just send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. Thanks again to my good friends Jacques Cordell and Wells, who collectively go by the name Chatul Hayuk, for letting us hear your music here in the salon. And thanks again to Ralph Abraham, not only for participating in these amazing conversations, but who also provided the recordings for me to use in these podcasts. And thank you again to Bruce Damer, who not only made the arrangements for the use of Ralph's tapes, but who also stayed up with me for several nights as we digitized them. So, hey, thanks again, Bruce. And for now, this is Lorenzo, signing off from Cyberdelic Space. I'll be back with you soon, but until then, be well, my friends.